them those who excelled many of the companions in intellectual acuteness, and, of course, they were extremely sincere men. It is during these early generations succeeding the companions that the juristic genius of Muslims comes to fruition, and it seems certain that the oft-quoted alleged hadith, "May God make that person prosper who listens to what I say carefully and then transmits it faithfully to others, for many a transmitter is less good or no good at understanding the meaning of my words compared with him to whom he might transmit it," arose among certain circles of jurists of these generations. For it is quite obvious that this hadith seeks to credit jurists with proper understanding, as opposed to traditionists who merely transmit reports from the Prophet. I have called this stage crucial, because it was during this period that an appeal to individual verses of the Quran and texts of hadith began to be made in order to resolve issues legally. If a sufficiently direct and obvious text was available, the matter was considered settled for good. If not, then a text had to be found that was close enough to the case under consideration so that the issue could be resolved on the basis of similarities, although allowing for differences. The first method was called nas, that is, decision on the basis of a clear text, while the second, more complicated procedure was called qiyas, that is, analogical reasoning. The nas has traditionally been considered the surest ground for decisions and thought to be absolutely incontrovertible. Yet the passage I quoted from al-Shatibi in the preceding section strongly contradicts this stand, for, according to al-Shatibi, no individual text by itself can have absolute probative force unless it is understood in the light of its historical background and the total relevant teaching of the Quran and the Sunnah. Indeed, al-Shaybani, the second-century Hanafi jurist, died 799, makes it plain that a certain text can become a nas, or textual proof, for more than one thing, depending on how you understand the text, so that the potentially probative words become a text depending upon what is understood from them. As for qiyas, or analogical reasoning, the method most commonly employed by most Muslim jurists to derive law from the Quran and the Sunnah, its use in the first century and a half of Islam naturally led to chaotic results and a bewildering richness of legal opinions in Islam. If a clear text can yield more than one opinion, one can scarcely imagine how qiyas, which operates by analogy, could lead to any uniform legal results. If, for one jurist, a certain verse of the Quran or a certain precedent of the Prophet constituted the basis of analogical reasoning for a given case, for another jurist, quite a different text or precedent offered a basis for analogical reasoning. If at this stage jurists had undertaken a systematic working out of the values and principles of the Quran instead of working with such loose tools, the results might have been astonishingly different. Not that difference of opinion could have been eliminated, this is neither possible nor desirable, but at least differences would have been minimized, and, what is more, these differences would have occurred on more intelligible and justifiable grounds, so that communication between different points of view would have become much easier. Instead, al-Shafi'i's, died 819, contention that a hadith, even though it be isolated and transmitted by only one transmissional chain, must be accepted as binding, and that in face of such a hadith no reasoning can be allowed, had to be accepted, because it provided an anchoring point in the midst of what seemed to be an interminable conflict of opinion. But even this proved inadequate, for already in al-Shafi'i's time and much more during the following century, a vast number of hadiths had become available, reflecting and supporting the very differences of opinion to which al-Shafi'i's principle was supposed to put an end. This proliferation of hadiths resulted in the cessation of an orderly growth in legal thought in particular and in religious thought in general. I say orderly growth because no functioning human society can be utterly static, Some changes always continue to occur. But in the Muslim world, these changes were neither controlled nor directed toward an end. Most modern Muslim thinkers have laid the blame for this relatively static state of affairs on the destruction of the caliphate in the mid-13th century and the political disintegration of the Muslim world. But, as my preceding analysis has shown, the spirit of Islam had become essentially static long before that. Indeed, this stagnation was inherent in the basis on which Islamic law was founded. The development of theology displays the same characteristics even more dramatically than does legal thought. This theology, Kalam, which took shape during the 10th, 11th, and 12th centuries CE, came to claim for itself the exalted function of being the defender of the basis of Islamic law, in its most dominant and enduring form of Ash'arism. As such, it rejected causality and the efficacy of the human will in the interests of divine omnipotence. Man was therefore only metaphorically an actor, the real actor being God alone. Declared good and evil to be knowable only through the revelation and not through natural reason, and denied that divine commandments in the Quran had any purpose. They were rather to be obeyed solely because they were divine commandments. The main elaborator of Ash'arite doctrine, Al-Bakilani, 10th century CE, even recommended that belief in the atomism of time and space, that is, rejection of causality, should be officially required from Muslims. All this happened long before the destruction of the caliphate. It is true that Ash'arism succeeded only gradually in establishing its hold over the Muslim world and that the support of a Sufi like Al-Ghazali, died 1111, proved crucial for its spread and ultimate dominance as the creed of the vast majority of Sunni Islam. Nevertheless, it is not an unfair indicator of the onset of rigidity in Islamic spiritual and intellectual life that the theological system of Al-Ash'ari's contemporary, the Hanafi Al-Maturidi, born in Maturid, a village near Tashkent, which held more reasonable views than Ash'arite theology on all the issues just mentioned, was eventually drowned by Ash'arism in medieval Islam. There is also little doubt that a sort of affinity of spirit developed between Ash'arism and certain more extreme forms of Sufism, like the very widespread Sufism of the 13th century Ibn Arabi, which affirmed that there was one and only one existence in reality, namely God, and regarded all else as illusion, shadow, or appearance. But the wild rampage of this type of Sufism in the later medieval centuries is itself proof enough whither the winds were blowing and whence. This is not to deny the refinements of spirit or the intellectual sophistication and originality shown by many great Sufis, and it is undoubtedly true, say from the 12th century onward, that in the face of the barrenness of official Islam, law and theology, most creative minds in the Muslim world gravitated into the Sufi fold. The question, however, is, does this Sufism, with its pantheistic matrix, bear any relationship either to the theology or the social message of the Quran, or, indeed, to the conduct of the Prophet himself and that of the early generations of Muslims? Institutional change in medieval Islam. I said a while ago that changes continued to occur in medieval Muslim society, but that these changes were not orderly or controlled. This statement has to be elaborated more precisely. First of all, the general notion that the medieval Islamic society was completely static must be dismissed as, at the very least, misleading. Modern social scientists have discovered that primitive societies are characterized by stability, but that since they lack movement, they also lack growth and creativity. The term stable is a euphemism for static or rigid, but many social scientists prefer it because it seemingly avoids value judgment. Gunnar Myrdal found this discovery illuminating in his Asian Drama, when he analyzed the backwardness of Asian countries. But surely this formula so blandly stated is both simplistic and wrong. One must ask in what respects a society is stable, and in what respects changing, and if changing, whether for better or for worse. It has been found that in primitive societies, conditions are so stable, and the hold of societies over individuals so complete, that even the latter's dreams are socially engineered and tend to be predictable. A society may suffer from political instability and upheavals, yet be static in its social or economic or socio-economic life, as was more or less the case with medieval societies in both the East and the West. A society may be politically stable, but may undergo rapid economic growth, as has been the case generally in Western societies in recent history. Again, a society may show political stability, economic growth, and socio-moral decline, as has also been the case generally with Western societies in still more recent history. Yet again, an indifference to wealth through so-called moral concerns or indolence may result in mass poverty, which in turn may assume the proportions of a moral problem of the first order, as is the case in economically backward countries. Conversely, an obsession with purely economic values may result in social deformities and decline that may assume the character of a crucial moral issue, as is the case now with Western nations in general, and as Goldsmith warned in his poem, The Deserted Village. Ill fares the land, to hastening ills a prey, where wealth accumulates, but men decay. To return to social change in medieval Islam, a brief analysis will show that the story is complex at both the theoretical and the practical levels. In the political field, Sunni Islam continued essentially to legitimize and rationalize the actual state of affairs until the fall of the Baghdad Caliphate. Even after the destruction of the caliphate, Ibn Taymiyyah died 1328, recognizing the actual state of affairs, held that one global rule was not necessary for the Muslim community. What was necessary was cooperation among Muslim rulers and the discharge of their trust to their subjects. For Ibn Taymiyyah, the unity of the world Muslim community is far more fundamental than the unity of government, which, in any case, he held to be a necessary means to an end and not an end in itself. This principle he upheld against the Shi'i theologian Al-Hilli, died 1277, who, of course, held that rule by an infallible imam belongs to the very essence of religion. For the Shia, it became increasingly difficult to theoretically justify rulership in the continued absence of an infallible imam. In practice, however, there was little difference between the Sunni and Shi'i rulers, although the problem with the Shia was much more acute than with the Sunnis. Both were duty-bound, in principle, to accept the limitations on their power imposed by the Sharia, while both had little theoretical justification to fall back upon. Thus, we note that in this important field of public life, there was little or no normative link between practice and theory, primarily owing to the dearth of the latter in the later medieval centuries of Islam. In the still more important field of law, as I said earlier, the Islamic legal system, although in the main unsystematically linked with the Quran and the Sunnah, was not founded on a systematic intellectual working out of the socio-moral values of the Quran. In addition, from its very beginning, the legal literature of Islam has a bookish smell in contradistinction to the exigencies of everyday life. It is almost a purely theoretical effort. This effort is indeed vast and displays much originality, but strictly speaking it cannot be described as law, for since it is basically concerned with morality, much of it is not enforceable in any court except that of the human conscience. Nevertheless, as the 19th century Ottoman effort in the work Majalla clearly shows, a system of law can very well be built on it. The efforts of some modern Muslim states to replace the Sharia with purely secular law are mainly the result of intellectual defeatism. but it is true that, already in medieval Islam, certain trends in the field of law were highly detrimental to the integrity of Islamic law itself. While taking advantage of and appealing to the principles of social necessity and public interest that the Muslim jurists themselves had enunciated for the convenience of administration, so that they would not remain hidebound by the provisions of the Sharia law even when circumstances demanded otherwise, Muslim rulers at the same time freely resorted to promulgating state-made law that was neither Islamic nor yet secular. There was nothing inherently wrong with these two principles themselves, provided their actual application had been reasoned on the Sharia basis. But when rulers began to feel free to promulgate their own laws based on the principles of social necessity and public interest in the absence of any reformulation or rethinking of Islamic law, the results were disastrous for Islamic law itself. What was required but never achieved was a constant reformulation and expansion of Islamic law that would have preserved its integrity and efficacy. As I have just said, there was much that was original and fertile in the vast literature of Islamic jurisprudence, but this was out of touch with actual legal practice. The quotation from Al-Shatibi cited in the first section of this chapter is one instance of this fertility and originality, but there are many other instances where Muslim jurists and thinkers tried to break a new trail. Iz ad-Din ibn Abd al-Salam al-Sulami, 13th century CE, for example, rejected the ban on interest that had been almost unanimously pronounced by Muslim lawyers, as he rejected stoning to death as punishment for adultery, and roundly declared the entire traditional material on the issue to be utterly unreliable. Indeed, in all great Muslim thinkers up to and including the 18th century Shah Wali Allah of Delhi, there is no dearth of revolutionary statements. But orthodoxy had developed an amazing shock-absorbing capacity. All these thinkers were held in high esteem by orthodox circles as great representatives of Islam, but such statements of theirs as had some radical import were invariably dismissed as isolated, shadd, or idiosyncratic, and were quietly buried. It took real rebels like Ibn Taymiyyah to make any perceptible dent in this steel wall of ijma', consensus. But while steady encroachments were being made upon the Sharia law, not only by the state-made law, but also by the customary law of different cultural regions, the ulama, the custodians of the Sharia, clung tenaciously, besides personal law, to two segments of the Sharia law, the five pillars of Islam, that is, the profession of the faith, prayer, fasting, zakat, and pilgrimage to Mecca on the one hand, and to the hudud, certain punishments specified in the Quran for certain crimes like murder, adultery, and theft on the other. I have called the first category minimal Islam and the second negative or punitive Islam. Actually, there was nothing theoretical at all to link these various items together. The integral teaching of the Quran and the historic struggle of the Prophet that provided the socio-moral context for these provisions and institutes and cemented them together had already been lost sight of. To medieval Muslim education, then, we must now turn briefly. What was taught, how and why, and what was the end product of this educational system and its main strengths and failures? Education in Medieval Islam. Although the beginnings of Islamic education, which meant learning the Quran and developing a system of piety around it, go back in some form to the Prophet's time, it was later in the first and second centuries of Islam that scattered centers of learning grew up around persons of eminence. These teachers would normally give a student a certificate or a permit, ijaza, to teach what he had been taught, which in most cases consisted exclusively of memorizing the Quran, copying down traditions from the Prophet and his companions, and deducing legal points from them. Organized schools with established curricula were probably first set up by the Shia to impart knowledge and indoctrinate students. When the Seljukids and Ayyubids replaced the Shia states in Iran and in Egypt, large madrasas or colleges organized on Sunni lines were established, and with time, they multiplied. With the establishment of the Shi'i Safavid dynasty in Iran in the 16th century, there grew up a number of Twelver Shia seats of higher learning, the most prominent of which, at present, is Qum. In Sunni Islam, the position of absolute prominence is held by Al-Azhar of Egypt, founded in the 10th century by the Ismaili Fatimids of Egypt and turned over to Sunni Islam after the Ayyubid conquest of Egypt in the late 12th century. What will interest us primarily in the following account is the nature and quality of this learning and the kind of man it aimed at producing for the service of Islam. I have outlined above the rise, growth, and character of Islamic law and theology. The first to develop was law, to meet obvious administrative and judicial needs, and this was followed by theology. Islamic law, as I indicated above, is not, strictly speaking, law, since much of it embodies moral and quasi-moral precepts not enforceable in any court. Further, Islamic law, though a certain part of it came to be enforced almost uniformly throughout the Muslim world, and it is primarily this that bestowed homogeneity upon the entire Muslim world, is, on closer examination, a body of legal opinions, or, as Santayana put it, an endless discussion on the duties of a Muslim, rather than a neatly formulated code or codes. In theory, therefore, this body, even though it became rigid and inflexible as actually applied, presents a bewildering richness of legal opinions and hence a great range and flexibility in the interpretation and actual formulation of the sacred law, the Sharia. In other words, a system of law or even a variety of legal systems can be created on the basis of this body of opinions, even though these opinions themselves do not, strictly speaking, constitute law. Law and theology formed the central part of the higher educational system of Islam imparted in the madrasas. The bare bones of Sunni theology, as formulated by Al-Ash'ari and his followers, were further elaborated into systems by Fakhr al-Din Arazi, died 1209, Al-Iji, died 1355, and others, by incorporating certain philosophical themes like essence and existence, causation, the nature of God's attributes, and prophethood, while at the same time refuting the theses of Muslim philosophers like Ibn Sina and substituting for them the counter-theses of Kalam. Similarly, the historically less important, although more reasonable, theses of the Sunni Kalam system founded by Al-Maturidi were elaborated further by writers like Al-Nasafi, died 1310, and his commentator Al-Taftazani, died 1389. By contrast, a great revolution had occurred in Shi'i theology during the 10th to 11th centuries CE. While, until then, Shi'i Kalam had been rather crude and anthropomorphic, an apparently sudden and remarkable change took place whereby the Shia incorporated, possibly in opposition to Sunni Kalam, the central Mu'tazilite doctrine of the freedom of the human will and a general emphasis on reason, although they did not accept the Mu'tazilite doctrine that good and evil are discernible by human reason, postulating instead an infallible imam as the source of sure knowledge. These skeletons of the 11th century Shi'i Kalam were further developed in the work of the famous Shi'i philosopher and theologian Nasir al-Din al-Tusi, died 1274, and particularly by his brilliant disciple al-Hilli, not by rejecting philosophy as in the Sunni case, but by largely accepting it. Once the madrasas were organized, it was these legal and theological systems that were administered to students. We know almost nothing of what was taught in the early colleges of the 12th, 13th, and 14th centuries, It is certain, however, that from the very beginning certain distinctions were made according to which various sciences or branches of learning were classified. Some of these distinctions, for example, between theoretical and practical sciences and between universal, kulli, and particular, juz'i, sciences, were of Greek origin. By the theoretical and practical sciences was generally meant theology, also called ilm al-tawhid, science of the unity of God, or usul al-din, principles of faith, or, later on, ilahiyat, science of theology, on the one hand, and law, called fiqh, or later sharia, on the other. But when law was more systematically grounded in basic principles, these principles of law, that is, jurisprudence, usul al-fiqh, were distinguished as a separate science from the actual law or legal rules, ilm al-furu, that is, the science of details, called fiqh or sharia, although both these terms continued to be used for both legal sciences. But the most fateful distinction that came to be made in the course of time was between the religious sciences, ulum sharia, or traditional sciences, ulum naqliya, and the rational or secular sciences, ulum aqliya or ghair sharia, toward which a gradual stiffening and stifling attitude was adopted. There are several reasons for this perilous development. First of all, the view is expressed recurrently that, since knowledge is vast while life is short, one must fix priorities, and these will naturally be in favor of the religious sciences, upon whose acquisition one's success in the hereafter depends. It is extremely important to appreciate this psychological attitude, which does not reject the rational sciences as such, but discounts them as not conducive to one's spiritual welfare. The spread of Sufism, which, in the interests of cultivating an internal spiritual life and direct religious experience, was generally inimical not only to rational sciences but to all intellectualism, is again of great importance. Despite several reminders by men like the 17th century Haji Khalifa in his work Mizan al-Haq, or Balance of Truth, that the Quran untiringly invites men to think, ponder, and reflect upon the created universe and its extremely well-ordered and firm structure, wherein no dislocations or gaps can be found, owing to the widespread opposition of the ulama and their madrasa system to this attitude, the drift toward rejection of rational sciences continued. The third important reason for the gradual decline of science and philosophy was, of course, that while degree holders of religious sciences could get jobs as qaddis or muftis, a philosopher or a scientist was limited to court employment. Fourth, but not least important, was the attitude of certain extraordinarily important religious personalities like Al-Ghazali. Al-Ghazali was opposed not to science, per se, but to philosophy, as expounded by the great Muslim philosophers like Al-Farabi, and particularly Ibn Sina. Because of certain of their highly unorthodox metaphysical views, such as the eternity of the world, the purely symbolic nature of the prophetic revelation, and the rejection of physical resurrection, Al-Ghazali and other orthodox thinkers denounced these philosophers as gravely heretical. Al-Ghazali also asserts, rightly, that metaphysical speculation does not possess the certainty or demonstrative force of mathematical propositions. But, he goes on to say, wrongly, that since the philosophy of these men is harmful to faith, so must their scientific works also be shunned, since the latter tend to create goodwill in the students toward the philosophers, who were, of course, scientists too, and predisposes them to accept their philosophy. In his work, Mizan al-Amal, Criterion of Actions, Al-Ghazali also invokes the argument from priorities and inveighs against those doctors who want to give priority to the medical sciences over the religious and mislead the simple-minded public by clichés such as look after your health first and then your faith, badanaka thumma dinaka. How could the body assume priority over the soul? In general, primary education, given in the maktabs or kutabs, where reading and writing, reading of the Quran, prayers, and rudimentary arithmetic were taught, was a self-contained unit and did not feed into the higher educational system. Certain official colleges, particularly those founded by the Ottoman rulers, seem to have been fully graded. For example, the educational institution established by Mehmet Fatih, the conqueror, on both sides of the mosque he built after the conquest of Istanbul, is said to have comprised 16 schools. Now these 16 schools were actually 16 grades, beginning with the elementary and ending in some sort of specialization at the advanced level. The college, or university, of Mehmet Fatih had at its apex two divisions, one relating to religious sciences and the other to rational sciences. The first division comprised theology, ilahiyat, law, fiqh, and literature, adab, while the second division had natural sciences, natural philosophy, tabiyat, philosophy, hikmat, and medicine, tib. There were most probably no annual examinations, but students proceeded to the next higher grade at the recommendation of their teachers. So also seems to be the case with the madrasas of Suleiman the Magnificent. Again, we know little about the historical evolution of these institutions. Astronomy, mathematics, and philosophy were also taught in medieval Iranian educational systems, along with Islamic law and theology. But in Iran, although there was government aid for madrasas, the Safavids particularly cultivated a good relationship with the ulama. The madrasas were autonomous private organizations, hawza-i-ilmiya, or precincts of knowledge. After the 12th and 13th centuries, the high-level and creative philosophical tradition persisted only in Iran, where it has remained unbroken till the present. In Turkey and in the Indo-Pakistan subcontinent, however, though it continued to exist down to the modern period, its level, with few exceptions, was not high. Even in Iran, where, after the installation of Shiism as the state creed, philosophy continued to flourish astonishingly well, the larger body of the Shi'i Orthodox ulama have looked upon it with suspicion. That is to say, philosophy and real Orthodox thought have seldom intersected each other. And though philosophers like Muhammad Bakir Mirdamad and Mullah Sadra, both of the 16th to 17th centuries, have written on religion, their religious works seldom have been read for the sake of or have inspired Orthodox thought. In the Arab world, it appears that philosophy, and probably science as well, was stricken from the curriculum as being non-religious, while from the 14th century onward, the peculiarly Arab science of rhetoric and eloquence established itself as, besides theology, the major intellectual field among Orthodox scholars. This science of rhetoric and eloquence was engendered in the early centuries of Islam by the Mu'tazilite interest in the linguistic miraculousness, ijaz, of the Quran, and subsequently became an independent branch of learning, one having little to do with the Greek science of rhetoric, but based instead upon Arabic grammar. One reveled in appreciating rhetorical and grammatical points and niceties in an oration, a hadith, or a verse of the Quran. In the Quran commentary of the Egyptian Shahab ad-Din al-Hafaji, died 1659, for example, a good part of the first volume is directed to the grammatical analysis of the Quranic verse that appears at the beginning of each surah of the Quran, and that Muslims recite before any work or undertaking, namely, in the name of God, the Merciful, the Benevolent. Indeed, a large part of the Quran commentary literature in later medieval Islam is purely grammatical. The celebrated commentary of the Quran by al-Baydawi, died circa 1286, used so frequently in madrasas to teach the Quran, is just such a work. And so it came to pass that a vibrant and revolutionary religious document like the Quran was buried under the debris of grammar and rhetoric. Ironically, the Quran was never taught by itself, most probably through the fear that a meaningful study of the Quran by itself might upset the status quo, not only educational and theological, but social as well. So one needed extrinsic props to understand the Quran, and what prop could be more delicious and even intoxicating than the science of rhetoric and eloquence? It appears that at Al-Azhar in these later medieval centuries, this science took the place of philosophy and science, and along with theology, which included logic as an instrumental science, and law, constituted the essence of higher learning. As has been shown in a recently published work, there was a revival of certain secular sciences at Al-Azhar during the 18th and 19th centuries that preceded the modernization attempts in Egypt. In India, which remained for the most part at the periphery of Islamic intellectual developments, virtually no scientific studies developed. The 18th century scholar Al-Tahannavi tells us in the introduction to his famous Kashaf Istilahat al-Funun, Dictionary of Technical Terms, that he could not find a single place in India where he could study science, and therefore, in compiling the dictionary, he had to rely on books. A major development that adversely affected the quality of learning in the later medieval centuries of Islam was the replacement of the original texts of theology, philosophy, jurisprudence, and such, as materials for higher instruction with commentaries and super-commentaries. The process of studying commentaries resulted in the preoccupation with hair-splitting detail to the exclusion of the basic problems of a subject. Disputation, jadal, became the most fashionable procedure of winning a point, and almost a substitute for a genuine intellectual effort at raising and grappling with real issues in a field. In the earlier stages, a commentary on a work was the result of a teacher's teaching that work in a class. His comments would be written down by students and then compiled into a commentary with the teacher's approval. Later, certain eminent scholars would write a condensed tract in a certain field. For example, the Kitab al-Tajrid of Nasir ad-Din al-Tusi on theology, or a work in verse, like the Alfiya of Ibn Malik on Arabic grammar, comprising 1,000 verses, so that the student might find it easier to study it or memorize it. This resulted, on the one hand, in the unfortunate habit of learning materials by rote without any deeper understanding, and, on the other, in a proliferation of commentaries and super-commentaries, compounded refutations and counter-refutations. This fruitless ingenuity and waste of valuable intellectual energies culminated in such works as the Quranic commentary of Faizi, an eminent 16th-century man of letters and courtier of the Mughal ruler Akbar, wherein the author dispensed with the Arabic letters of the alphabet having diacritical marks, thus reducing the number of letters he could use from 28 to only 13. There are works written by certain Turkish scholars where, by reading words horizontally or vertically or in some cases diagonally, in each case successively or alternately, or by reading lines and not words alternately, on each page, one simultaneously obtains readable texts of as many as 5 disciplines, say, grammar, theology, law, logic, and philosophy, and in as many as 3 languages, Arabic, Turkish, or Ottoman, and Persian. Although the presence of a large common Arabic technical vocabulary greatly facilitates the task, such works undoubtedly represent incredible feats of mental gymnastics. Finally, this development was paralleled by another type of condensed text that was not written to ease the work of students, but, on the contrary, was designed to be difficult, quite like a puzzle, although it often had the merit of being easily memorizable. Commentary upon commentary was then essayed to interpret it, like Al-Khayali's, died 1457, commentary on Al-Taftazani's commentary on Al-Nasafi. Al-Khayali's work was so difficult that, after a series of unsuccessful commentaries upon him, the successful commentary was considered to be that of the 16th and 17th century Indian scholar Abd al-Hakim, called Al-Lahuri by later Arab authors. With the habit of writing commentaries for their own sake and the steady dwindling of original thought, the Muslim world witnessed the rise of a type of scholar who was truly encyclopedic in the scope of his learning, but had little new to say on anything. This category of scholar-cum-commentator must be distinguished, on the one hand, from a very different type of a comprehensive thinker like Aristotle, or even a lesser figure like Ibn Sina, who welded a variety of fields of inquiry into a unified system and coherent worldview, and on the other hand, from the modern type of specialist whose knowledge has extremely narrow confines. The latter-day medieval Muslim scholar I am talking about studied all the fields of knowledge available, but he did this mainly through commentaries and was himself a commentator and a compiler. This type of scholar is, of course, not confined to the Muslim world, but is also representative of many medieval European savants. One important but implicit assumption of this type is that scholarship is not regarded as an active pursuit, a creative reaching out of the mind to the unknown, as is the case today, but rather as the more or less passive acquisition of already established knowledge. This attitude naturally is not conducive to original inquiry and thought, since it assumes that all that can be known about reality is already known, except, perhaps, for a few gaps to be filled by interpretation and extension, or some angularities to be smoothed out. The view that mind is creative in knowledge is essentially a characteristic of modern theories of knowledge. Islamic mysticism produced its own theory of knowledge, holding that what is learned from books does not constitute knowledge at all. Knowledge is that which is vouchsafed to a Sufi by God in a direct, intuitive experience. Sufis rejected both learning and intellectual thought as positively harmful. This Sufi experience was characterized by immediacy and certainty that rendered it immune from falsehood and secure from doubt. Although a number of important post-12th century philosophers, such as Al-Suhrawardi, died 1191, Sadr ad-Din al-Shirazi, Mulla Sadra, died 1641, and others, advocated and claimed for themselves the ability to combine rationality with intuitive experience. Sufis, as such, poured contempt on rationality. In their Zawiyas or Khanqas, the Sufis, besides performing their spiritual exercises and providing guidance for their disciples, also taught important works of Sufi spirituality like the Mathnavi of Jalal al-Din ar-Rumi, died 1273. When later, the gap between the ulama and the Sufis became narrower, and many of the ulama themselves enrolled in the more orthodox Sufi orders, it was not uncommon for a khanqa to impart both a madrasa type of orthodox education and Sufi spiritual works, for which, indeed, the most popular Sufi figure of 11th century Baghdad, Abd al-Qadir al-Jilani, had already set an example. Islamic education in the Indo-Pakistan subcontinent. I stated earlier that education in Indian Islam was generally not of a very high order. This must be elaborated and made more specific. The fact is that when organized education got underway in India in the 13th and 14th centuries, the formative and creative stages of various sciences in Islam had already essentially passed, and these sciences were in fact either static or in decline. Outside India at that time, commentaries and encyclopedic learning held sway. It was these later texts and their commentaries, therefore, that came to form the content of Islamic education in India. The first sciences to be introduced were law and theology. In the 15th century, logic begins to receive more emphasis, as does the science of rhetoric and eloquence, and philosophy gains prominence during the Mughal period, particularly during the reign of Akbar. At about the same time, early 17th century, hadith receives its first major impulse, thanks to the writings of Abd al-Haq of Delhi, called the Muhaddith. In the 18th century, the famous Nizami curriculum, Dars-i-Nizami, was issued by Mullah Nizam ad-Din, died 1747, of the Firangi Mahal Madrasa in Lucknow. This was a 9 or 10 year syllabus of middle to higher education, including 16 different subjects and 83 works in all. The subjects, as has since become the common practice in most madrasas, progressed in the following manner. Arabic grammar, 12 works. Rhetoric, 3. Prosody, 1. Logic, 10. Philosophy, 4. Arabic literature, prose and poetry, 7. Theology, 5. History of Islam, 3. Medicine, including the part On Fevers of Ibn Sina's Qanun, 4. Astronomy, 2. Geometry, 1. 20 chapters of Euclid. Art of Disputation, 1. Law, 8. Jurisprudence, 6. Law of Inheritance, 1. Principles of Hadith, 1. Hadith, 10. Principles of Quran, Interpretation, 1. Quran, Commentaries, 4. For instruction in Principles of Quran, Interpretation, Usul al-Tafsir, Ahmad's list gives Al-Fawz al-Kabir fi Usul al-Tafsir by Shah Wali Allah of Delhi, died 1762. Since Nizam ad-Din returned to Delhi from his education in Medina about 1732 and died in 1747, either this work was written between these two dates or it was inserted into the syllabus after Nizam ad-Din's death, which may well be the case, since there are other works in the list that are definitely later insertions. This means that the syllabus began to be modified soon after its compilation. The trend has been toward simplification and the elimination of several works and even of whole fields like science and philosophy. Wali Allah himself wrote a much more simplified syllabus in which, although some of the physical sciences were kept, their importance was reduced. However, he strongly recommended that the Quran should be studied by itself without any commentary, if possible, and that the commentaries used should be brief ones that clarify grammatical constructions or meanings of words or give the historical background of the verses. While the syllabus of Nizam ad-Din is weighted toward rational sciences, that of Shah Wali Allah is weighted toward the core traditional sciences of Islam, law, theology, and hadith, with the innovation that he formally includes works of Sufism at the end of the syllabus, a novel feature in the Orthodox educational system. These two syllabi form the basis of practically all madrasa syllabi until today, with various combinations and modifications suiting the temper and orientation of a given institution, its founder, and its faculty. The general trend, undoubtedly under the impact of the profound fundamentalist influence of Wali Allah's school of thought, has been to eliminate the intellectual and rational sciences and emphasize the purely religious, orthodox disciplines. The wide propagation of hadith in the subcontinent is definitely due to the massive influence of Shah Wali Allah and his sons and students. The Deoband Seminary in northern India, UP, was established in the latter half of the 19th century by scholars descended from the school of Shah Wali Allah. Since, however, Wali Allah's school not only represented an educational institution like Nizam ad-Din's Firangi Mahal, but was essentially a puritanical reformist endeavor, this latter orientation, in its impact, proved a watershed. On the one hand, its mainstream came to be represented by institutions like the Deoband Seminary, although Deoband proved to be much less broad and interpretive than Wali Allah himself. On the other, it resulted in the rise of the Ahl-e Hadith school, which tended to be a right-wing extreme, emphasizing hadith to the exclusion not only of purely rational sciences like philosophy, but even of kalam theology, of whose validity it was, like the mainstream of the Hanbalites, very suspicious. But the purest ideas of the school of Wali Allah also created a strong reaction in the form of the 19th century Barilavi school of thought, which was a conscious reassertion, in the face of Deoband and the Ahle Hadith, of the mass religion, with strong overtones of popular Sufi beliefs in the powers of saints and mythification of the person of the Prophet Muhammad. It took its name from the town of Bareilly, whence hailed its most vocal representative, Muhammad Riza, who waged lengthy disputations with his opponents on such questions as whether the Prophet Muhammad was all-knowing, ilm al-ghaib, the unseen, whether he had a body of light, and so forth. Whereas politically, Deoband and Ahli Hadith were in general patently anti-British, representatives of the Barilavi school issued authoritative statements, fatwas, in favor of British rule. In Pakistan, then, besides the Shi'i madrasas, there have survived three types of traditional Sunni madrasas, the Deobandi, the Ahli Hadith, and the Barilavi. While at the time of partition, Pakistan had only 137 madrasas, the number rose to 210 in 1950, 401 in 1960, and 563 in 1971. The total number of big and small madrasas is said to be at least 893, with a total of 3,186 teachers and 32,384 regular students. The rapid increase in the number of madrasas since the establishment of Pakistan is striking. The basic reason for this increase is no doubt that the state of Pakistan was established on the basis of Islam. It is interesting that increase in the number of madrasas and in knowledge about traditional Orthodox Islam appears to have been much more marked in smaller towns and in the countryside. In some areas of the Punjab, it has been spectacular. Than in the cities, where Karachi and Lahore have also seen expansion in madrasas. Whereas in the cities, traditional Islam progressively yields to industry and secular education, resulting in modern interpretations of Islam or secularism, traditional Orthodox Islam has gained immense ground in smaller towns. I shall try to trace this whole development in the next two chapters. Chapter 2. Classical Islamic Modernism and Education. Introduction. We saw in Chapter 1 that a kind of secularism appeared in the Muslim world in pre-modernist times because of the stagnation of Islamic thinking in general, and more particularly because of the failure of Sharia law and institutions to develop themselves to meet the changing needs of the society. This affected the course of modern Islam, particularly in the field of education, as we shall see in this chapter. There are, however, substantial differences in the character of modern developments in different Muslim regions, which are perhaps mainly to be accounted for by four factors. 1. Whether a particular cultural region retained its sovereignty vis-à-vis the European political expansion, and whether it was dominated and governed de jure or de facto by a European colonial power. 2. The character of the organization of the ulama, or religious leadership, and the character of their relationship with the governing institutions before the colonial encroachment. 3. The state of the development of Islamic education and its accompanying culture immediately before the colonial encroachment. And 4. The character of the overall colonial policy of the particular colonizing power, British, French, or Dutch. Thus, among those important Muslim countries that came under Western influence, Turkey alone managed to keep her independence from direct or indirect rule, although not from all sorts of Western pressures and interventions. While Arabia, for example, though a religiously and hence politically important Muslim country, did not experience any Western impact. Again, while India came under direct British rule for a long period, and while North Africa came under French rule and Indonesia under Dutch, Egypt and Iran came under such Western hegemonic pressures that even though their rulers were generally not as powerless or titular as, for example, those of Nigeria, their policies were not independent. Again, whereas both the British and the Dutch colonial policies allowed the cultures and educational systems of the countries they ruled to remain and to develop more or less freely, the French policy of assimilation tried to implant French culture and education not by the side of native culture and education, but at their expense, and indeed in Algeria, at the cost of their almost total annihilation. The French also encouraged the Sufi orders in North Africa over the Orthodox Islam of the Ulama, which they feared, whereas the British and the Dutch, on the whole, did not do this. Their policies, if anything, were more conducive to the growth of Orthodox Islam. I shall also have to leave out of this study the Central Asian Islamic lands, where all religious education and, indeed, life was blighted by the Soviet communist regime. Although Islam has seen some revival there lately, together with an underground resistance movement, mainly Sufi, proper information is lacking. This much for factors 1 and 4 enumerated above by way of introduction. Their elaboration will come presently when I treat different regions of the Muslim world in greater detail. Factor 2 concerns the nature of the organization of the ulama and their relationship with the political authority in pre-colonial days. Here again, we see great differences. Whereas, for example, the ulama were highly organized in Egypt, where they were practically concentrated at Al-Azhar, and in Turkey, they were quite scattered in India, although they were nevertheless always a powerful element in the state as well, and in Indonesia. In Iran, although the ulama enjoyed greater influence over state policies than their Sunni counterparts, except in Turkey, they were gathered in madrasas at certain main centers, but had no overall organization. Furthermore, while in Turkey the ulama represented a powerful class of the governing authority, almost like a Christian ecclesia, the term alim in the Ottoman Empire did not mean only a scholar or a religious scholar, as it normally did in the Muslim world, but designated an official status. In Egypt, there was no such quasi-ecclesiastic service beyond that of the government judges that existed throughout the Muslim world, and indeed in India and Indonesia, they hardly had any aura of official power. As for the state of development of the medieval Islamic educational system before the impact of the West, we recall from the preceding chapter that the later medieval centuries saw a marked decline, indeed a stagnation, of intellectual life in the Muslim world. From the 13th and 14th centuries onward, there was an era of manuals, commentaries, and supercommentaries. That a great deal of ingenuity lies buried in these generally ponderous and repetitive works, and that in Iran there was much originality in philosophy, is indubitable, but in an overall review, this literature is singularly unoriginal, pedantic, and superficial. Still, the most highly developed countries in terms of sophistication, if not originality, were Turkey and Egypt, mainly because the traditional education in these countries was highly organized and concentrated. Since state Shiism set Iran apart from the rest of the Muslim world, that country became basically isolated and developed a spiritualized intellectualism known as Irfan, or Islamic Gnosis, which, although it did make some impact on India, is almost peculiar to Iran from the 16th through the 19th centuries. Behind Turkey, Egypt, and Iran came India, with some of its most brilliant commentaries and a few original thinkers, like the 18th century Shah Wali Allah of Delhi and his 19th century school. What is now Pakistan could boast of the internationally known commentator intellectual of the 17th century, Abd al-Hakim of Sialkot, called Al-Lahuri by the Arabs. But besides that, it possessed little by way of first-rate intellectual productivity and much more of Sufi orders. Indeed, in the countryside of Pakistan, and even in many of its towns, Orthodox learning did not become widespread until after 1947. Perhaps this pre-modernist relative intellectual poverty in Pakistan largely explains its current situation in the field of general intellectual development, both religious and non-religious. In Indonesia, Orthodox learning at a high level was hardly cultivated before the beginning of the 20th century. Beginning with the year 1900, certain Indonesians who had gone to Mecca and spent years there cultivating Orthodox Islamic intellectualism, notably Orthodox theology and hadith, began spreading their learning in the Indonesian pesantrens, which gradually developed into madrasas. In the 1930s, the influence of Cairo's Al-Azhar assumed a certain dominance in Indonesian Islam. It is highly interesting and significant, as we shall see in greater detail later, that those Indonesian ulama who were trained in Cairo became members of the more progressive and modernist Muhammadiyah organization, while those coming from Mecca enrolled largely in the conservative and more typically Javanese Nahdlatul al-Ulama, which was nearer to the folk Islam of Java than was the former. Yet, important though these local and regional differences are in the development of the Muslim responses to modernizing changes in the field of education, and it will be a major concern of mine to bring these differences out, the underlying uniformity of these responses must not be lost sight of. Despite stimuli of various degrees of directness and intensity, the responses were basically conditioned by the nature of the medieval intellectual temper of Islam, which, thanks to the amazing uniformity of the madrasa education, was equally amazingly uniform. Before coming to portray the regional developments in practice in Islamic educational modernism, therefore, I will try to analyze the theoretical bases of this practical response. These theoretical bases themselves show a development throughout the 19th and 20th centuries, with different strands of the modernist argument sometimes going on simultaneously, sometimes succeeding one another, but always functionally related to the élan and justification of change. Theoretical considerations. Two basic approaches to modern knowledge have been adopted by modern Muslim theorists. One, that the acquisition of modern knowledge be limited to the practical technological sphere, since at the level of pure thought, Muslims do not need Western intellectual products. Indeed, that these should be avoided, since they might create doubt and disruption in the Muslim mind, for which the traditional Islamic system of belief already provides satisfactory answers to ultimate questions of worldview, and, two, that Muslims without fear can and ought to acquire not only Western technology, but also its intellectualism, since no type of knowledge can be harmful, and that, in any case, science and pure thought were assiduously cultivated by Muslims in the early medieval centuries, whence they were taken over by Europeans themselves. To be sure, there are various nuances of these views and also middle-term positions. For example, that besides technology, pure science is also good, but not the pure thought of the modern West, or the more recent view that technology may even be harmful without adequate ethical training. But the two approaches set out here provide a good starting point for the modernist discussion of education. It is obvious that the first view is conducive to a dualistic attitude and will eventually result in a secularist state of mind, that is, a duality of loyalty to religion and to worldly affairs. This first approach was considered the patently correct answer to the problem of the modernization of education in the early phase of Turkish modernism, in which modern education was identified with useful skills and practical knowledge. The chief reason for this official attitude was, of course, that the ulama, the official class of religious leaders, was against the modernizing of the Muslim mind through education, acquiring practical skills, that is, professional knowledge, engineering, medicine, etc., called fun, plural funun, was all right, provided the traditional madrasa education was left free to impart ilm, that is, the Sharia knowledge for the cultivation of the Muslim mind and spirit. To the Turkish reformers in general, this dualism represented the dualism of the eternal and the changing, which were identified respectively with religion, the otherworldly, and mundane life, the this-worldly. For many modernists, this may have been primarily a question of strategy, to minimize the offense to the ulama, but that the ulama as a whole should have regarded it as inoffensive seems strange to us now, for in the sphere of this world lies the whole gamut not only of skills, but of social life, with its institutions and laws in which the Sharia claims to operate. But neither the modernist nor the ulama at this stage clearly saw the implications of educational modernization in terms of skills for social life and its values. This practical bent is clearly brought out in the educational reforms of the era of Mahmud II that led to the mentality of the Tanzimat leaders. While education could not be touched by the modernists, nor the higher madrasa education, the emphasis fell on the creation of higher professional education, engineering, medicine, and so forth. On primary education, Mahmud's